The CEM Network is pleased to present Ronald L. Dart and Born to Win.
I think I'm beginning to understand something that has troubled me for a long time. Not long ago, in a radio program, I said something to the effect that journalism has been thoroughly corrupted by the pursuit of profit. I later came to feel that I was missing something in that, and a letter from a listener, himself a graduate of journalism school, helped me get the issue in better focus. In the interest of getting me to reconsider, he enclosed a copy of something called The Journalist's Creed. I didn't even know there was something like a Hippocratic Oath for journalists. The Creed was written by Dean Walter Williams, the first dean of journalism at Missouri University. I want to share it with you, but before I do, I want to clarify what I said about the pursuit of profit. There's nothing at all wrong with the pursuit of profit per se, and if the advertising division of a newspaper is kept far enough away from the editorial department of a newspaper, well, that's a step in the right direction. But that's not where the problem really is. It's on a much higher floor of the building. The problem is that an influential newspaper is a source of power, and power corrupts. It's just as apt to corrupt a newspaper as it is the halls of Congress. I came across some studies recently that caused me to rethink the issue. During the 2008 political campaign, a columnist in the Washington Post named Shankar Vendadam wrote, "A series of new experiments show that misinformation can exercise a ghostly influence on people's minds after it has been debunked, even among people who recognize it as misinformation. In some cases, correcting misinformation serves to increase the power of bad information." End of quotation. Now, you talk about something that's counterintuitive. You would think that correcting misinformation would change somebody's attitude, but it tends to reinforce the power of the bad information. Now, I've really observed this in theological discussion, so I had little trouble believing it to be true. Here's an example I cited before about what was found. In experiments conducted by political scientists named John Bullock at Yale University, they took some volunteers and they gave them various items of political misinformation from real life. One group of volunteers was shown a transcript of an ad created by NARAL. I mentioned this before, the pro-choice America that accused John Roberts, who was President Bush's nominee to the Supreme Court at the time, of, quote, supporting violent fringe groups and a convicted clinic bomber. Now, a variety of psychological experiments have shown, this is according again to the Washington Post, that political misinformation primarily works by feeding into people's pre-existing views. That's easy to understand and believe. You already have something you believe, and then misinformation comes along that actually agrees with you, even though it's false. It tends to make your views stronger. People who did not like Roberts to begin with, well, they were the most receptive to the damaging information. That's exactly what Bullock found. Democrats were far more likely than Republicans to disapprove of Roberts after hearing the allegation, even though the allegation was not true. Then the researchers went and showed volunteers a refutation of the ad by abortion rights supporters. He also told the volunteers that the advocacy group had withdrawn the ad. The people who put out the misinformation pulled it because it was wrong. And before it happened, before any of this happened, 56% of Democrats disapproved of Roberts before they heard the misinformation. Afterward, 80% of the Democrats disapproved of the Supreme Court nominee. Now, what do you suppose happened when they got the refutation and the original people who put the original ad out withdrew it? Democratic disapproval of Roberts dropped to 72%. That's nearly 20 points higher than it was before the whole exercise started. Now, you've probably heard this before, that people deplore negative ads and going negative in political campaigns, and you wonder, well, why do people do it? Answer, because it works. Now, getting at things like this is hard, and it's really easy to misinterpret results. But there's not a lot of question about this. It's completely in comport with what you may have seen yourself in human nature. The columnist went on to cite some other studies, but when I got through the column, I wondered to what extent the columnist himself was skewing the reporting on the findings because of his own bias. Can you see the concern here? Who is to say that the journalist has not been influenced in the same way the volunteers in the study had been influenced by misinformation? And if you don't think that affects him when he sits down at his keyboard before his computer, you're being naive. Now, I can see that one factor at work here is the fear of being shown you have been wrong in your judgment, whether it's politics, your family, coworkers, religion, or any other area where you hold strong opinions. Fear is a powerful motivator, and it can skew a person's judgment, whether he be politician, journalist, or preacher. Let's just own up to it. And the fear of being shown to have been wrong, the fear of having to say, I was wrong, I made a big mistake on that, is pretty heavy. This state of mind, it can boil down to a refusal to face facts, to face the truth. You might call that, in biblical terms, a spirit of unbelief. In the book of Hebrews, the author wrote about this state of unbelief. Hebrews chapter 3, verse 12. He wrote, "Take heed, brothers, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. But exhort one another daily while it's called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin." Now, it's not hard to see this at one level. For example, it's a rare person who is involved in an extramarital affair, which is sin. It's a rare person who doesn't look for reasons to justify what he's doing. Would he take comfort from the flow of disinformation about the effects of the sexual revolution? In other words, it's okay, there's nothing wrong with it, everybody does it, which is one of the most common things you hear all the time in politics. You can point out that somebody did something bad. The answer is, well, the other guy and the other party did the same thing. We need to learn something, folks. Everybody does it is not a defense. But if we're doing something we shouldn't do, it may be a comfort, even if it's not a defense. I think it's fair to say most people would tend to skew information to justify what they are doing. It's what Hebrews calls the deceitfulness of sin. And it isn't hard to see how a person could become hardened against facts that point to his error. And this is what the author of Hebrews is warning us against. Don't let yourself get hardened. And that's the situation we're in. When we have our mind so made up that even correcting disinformation tends to make us harder, we're in trouble. Hebrews goes on. "For we are made partakers of Christ if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast to the end. While it is said today, if you will hear his voice, don't harden your hearts as in the provocation." Now, because his readers are Hebrews, they know the background from their history, he can briefly call it to record. He says, "For some, when they had heard, did provoke." He's talking about the Israelites in the wilderness. "Not all of them that came out of Egypt by Moses, but with whom was he grieved for 40 years? Wasn't it with those who sinned and whose carcasses fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear they wouldn't enter into his rest, but to those who would not believe?" So we see they could not enter in because of unbelief. Now, it's obvious unbelief can be repented and a person can change. It's also obvious at the same time that many, and even perhaps most, simply don't. It's clear in the biblical record. It's clear in research by academics, people, perhaps even journalists, become fixed in their views and cannot change. Not surprisingly, the early Christian church was not immune to this very human tendency. Grab a pencil and a pad. I want to give you an address, a phone number, and a free offer, and I'll be right back to explain.
King Solomon was easily the wisest man who ever lived, and his work is worth reading on that basis alone. But there is more to the story than that. To discover more, write or call and ask for a free introductory CD titled The Wisdom Books, Walking with the Wise. Write to Born to Win, Post Office Box 560, White House, Texas 75791. Or call toll-free 1-888-BIBLE-44.
It's clear enough in the New Testament, and it's, you know, if you read it, it's understandable as human nature, that the first Christians were almost desperate in their hope for the kingdom of God. Life was really not good for Christians in the first century. It was worth your life to even mention that you were a Christian in certain circumstances. So the kingdom of God, the coming of the kingdom, was their daily prayer. Paul kind of dropped a brick in his first letter to the Thessalonians because he made reference to the end and almost implied that it was going to be soon. And he had to write them again and clarify it for the record. You'll find this in 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter. He starts off by saying, "Now we beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our gathering together unto him, that you be not soon shaken in mind or troubled, neither by spirit nor by word nor by any letter from us, that the day of Christ is at hand." Now, it isn't hard to see how a people praying daily for the kingdom to come would grasp at anything that reinforced that hope. So Paul has to correct the error if he can. Our problem in reading the letter is we lack the foundation the church had from Paul's time there. We're reading somebody else's mail, and we don't know a lot of things that Paul had a right to assume that they knew. He goes on to say, "Don't let anyone deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except." Now, at this, he tosses in a number of exceptions, which I gather they understood. There was a sequence of events that would absolutely have to happen before Christ came. They hadn't happened yet, and therefore they should not expect an immediate return of the kingdom. Okay, except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or worshipped, so that he, as God, sits in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Don't you remember when I was there, I told you all this? What Paul is trying to do here is to go back in their minds before the apparent misunderstanding and kind of give them, well, to press the reset button. It's hard. Once something gets in people's minds, to get it out of there. So he's going to leapfrog back before that. I told you all this before. I gather he had laid out, when he was there in person, a sequence of events that had to precede the return of Christ, events that were not yet in evidence. Now, this is really a very difficult passage in the Greek, and translations vary on how they deal from it here. And the biggest problem of all is we don't know what went before. Anyway, Paul continued, "Now you know what's holding him back so that he can be revealed at the proper time. For the secret power of lawlessness is already at work, but he who now holds it back will continue to do so until he is taken out of the way." Now, the Greek is ambiguous here. It has prompted endless speculation, and I don't want to go down that path today to try to explain what it was all about. "Then that lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will overthrow with the breath of his mouth and destroy by the splendor of his coming." So we're looking about second coming stuff, aren't we? Now, here comes what is relevant to the present discussion we're having. "The coming of the lawless one," Paul said, "will be in accordance with the work of Satan, displayed in all kinds of counterfeit miracles, signs, and wonders, and in every sort of evil that deceives those who are perishing." So there's going to be a lot of disinformation, some of which will be received by a lot of people. Why? He said they perish because they refused to love the truth and so to be saved. "For this reason, God sends them a powerful delusion so that they will believe the lie, and so that all will be condemned who have not believed the truth, but have delighted in wickedness." You know, the very idea of believing the lie ought to strike fear into our hearts, because the truth is it lies around us all the time. You can't turn on television without seeing a lie. You can't pick up your newspaper without reading a lie. What's the antidote to it for us? It is to love the truth even when the truth is painful. And sometimes it is. It's to love the truth even when the truth tips over our basket of goodies and strips us down and leaves us standing there with our bare bottom hanging out. To love the truth even then is a challenge. Not long afterward, I came across an article in the journal called First Things that underlined this point. It was an article by Mary Eberstadt called The Will to Disbelieve. It appeared in February of 2009. Her article was about the sexual revolution and the continuing denial by too many people of the terrible effects it has brought about, especially upon women and children. The information is out there for anybody who wants to go get it, but it just keeps being denied and denied and denied. But she didn't start out with it. She opened with a classic, undeniable example of intellectual blindness to facts and to truth. Her example, well drawn out, was the way academia, the intellectual people, the intelligentsia, refused to see the evil of Marxism, refused to acknowledge its failure in the Soviet Union. And I cannot imagine a clearer example of the abject failure of an ideology. At the same time, though, it's staggering to realize that even in the face of fact after fact after fact after fact, there were any number of people then, and in fact there are even some diehards now in universities who really want to or refuse to face the fact that socialism, communism, Marxism failed dramatically. Now, putting all this together, Ms. Eberstadt summarized. She says, in retrospect, this formidable perversity, this otherwise inexplicable act of intellectual abdication, was more than just an outbreak of intellectual slumming. It was, in effect, one of the defining features of the Cold War. The denial. And she's talking here about the denial of the evil of the Marxist and communist and socialist system. The denial stretched across the Western intelligentsia from Seoul, Korea, to Boston, from Oslo to Buenos Aires, and just about every point in between. Wherever people clever enough to ignore the evidence could invent seemingly sophisticated reasons for doing so. Such profound and systematic resistance to the empirical facts was dubbed by the stalwart anti-communist Jean Kirkpatrick as the will to disbelieve. In an essay she wrote by that name, it's a fine phrase, she said, that deserves resurrecting in a different context today. And it really does, and in a way that's what I'm doing, is resurrecting the concept of the will to disbelieve. The expression cuts like a knife. She went on to note, as Malcolm Muggeridge once observed, people do not believe lies because they have to, but because they want to. That is so important. Let me read it to you again. Malcolm Muggeridge. People do not believe lies because they have to, but because they want to. I can't help it. I got to repeat Paul. For this reason, God sends them a powerful delusion so they will believe the lie. And so all will be condemned who have not believed the truth but have delighted in wickedness. Now, I told you all that to come back to the journalist's creed. As I told you, it was written by the first dean of the Missouri School of Journalism, Walter Williams. And here, a century later, it's hanging on the wall in one of the stairways of Neff Hall at the University of Missouri. Here's what it says. I believe in the profession of journalism. I believe that the public journal is a public trust, that all connected with it are, to the full measure of their responsibility, trustees for the public, that acceptance of a lesser service than the public service is a betrayal of this trust. I believe that clear thinking and clear statement, accuracy and fairness are fundamental to good journalism. I believe that a journalist should write only that which he holds in his heart to be true. I believe that suppression of the news for any consideration other than the welfare of society is indefensible. Now, this is all very admirable. Do you see the problem yet? Have you spotted the weakness? What happens when a journalist is not thinking clearly? Notice it said, I believe that clear thinking and clear statement, they're fundamental to good journalism, but what if he's not thinking clearly? And why should we think he is any more immune to muddle than anyone else is? when you've got the intelligentsia from one end of the world to another for generation after generation believing a lie, why on earth should we expect journalists to be any smarter than that? We already know a man can hold a lie in his heart when he thinks it is true. And whose definition of the welfare of society controls? Notice that? He said he's only to write these things when he can't consider anything except the welfare of society when he writes. Who's to say, how's to define the welfare of society? Now, it's right here that I had an epiphany, and I'll come back to it. But first of all, again, grab your pencil and pad. I want to give you another offer, and then I'll be right back.
For a free copy of this radio program that you can share with friends and others, write or call this week only and request the program titled The Will to Disbelieve. Write to Born to Win, Post Office Box 560, White House, Texas 75791. Or call toll-free 1-888-BIBLE-44. And tell us the call letters of this radio station.
The Creed goes on to say, I believe that advertising, news, and editorial columns should alike serve the best interest of readers, that a single standard of helpful truth and cleanness should prevail for all, that the supreme test of good journalism is the measure of its public service. Problem. In an atmosphere of lies, how does one find a single standard of helpful truth that they call for here? And what about unhelpful truth? Are we going to consider that something we're not going to report on it? It's true. It's a fact. But it's not helpful. Who gets to decide that? Especially with unhelpful truth, can an honest journalist toss a story out that he knows to be true because in his judgment or his editor's judgment, it's unhelpful? The Creed goes on to conclude, I believe that the journalism which succeeds best and best deserves success, fears God and honors man, is stoutly independent, unmoved by pride of opinion or greed of power, constructive, tolerant, but never careless, self-controlled, patient, always respectful of its readers, but always unafraid, is quickly indignant at injustice, is unswayed by the appeal of privilege or the clamor of the mob, seeks to give every man a chance, and as far as law and honest wage and recognition of human brotherhood can make it so, an equal chance. He is profoundly patriotic while sincerely promoting international goodwill and cementing world comradeship, is a journalism of humanity and for today's world. You know, in this last paragraph, I think we can come to understand why it is that large chunks of today's news media are failing. They don't deserve success on the criteria cited here. Even patriotism has been called into question by journalists. Did you notice that? After 9/11, there were journalists who wore flags on their lapels, and there were other journalists who said, well, we shouldn't do that because we can't be supporting a government and reporting on the government. Oh, I understand what they're saying. And yet the Journalist Creed says that a journalist is profoundly patriotic. Actually, this creed helps me understand the failure of journalism in today's world. Because what it does, it provides cover for a man who reads and says, oh, I believe in this. I follow the Journalist Creed, because he's doing what he thinks is best for society, when in truth, he's slanting it. I began to realize that the problem with journalism arises long before the profit or power motive comes into play. There is widespread belief among Americans that the media in the 2008 election were in the tank for Barack Obama. If they were supporting him, I suspect, is because they thought his election would be good for the country. Okay? It's a very small step from that to just not seeing news that might reflect against the preferred candidate. A small step to say, to spend a little extra time and space covering what made the other candidate look bad. Now, naturally, that's contrary to the Journalist Creed. Is anybody going to sit there with a straight face, though, and tell me that did not happen in the 2008 election? In a way, the election of 2008 looks to me like an exercise of affirmative action by the population, aided and abetted by journalists. Everybody thought, wouldn't it be cool? Wouldn't it make a statement if the United States elected a black man to be president? I might not have thought so if it hadn't been for all the news items that made it clear that it was so. Do you remember back during that campaign a remark by Geraldine Ferraro? Now, she's a Democrat, the first woman ever to be nominated for the office of vice president. She spoke the truth. She said, if Barack Obama had been white, he would never have been nominated by the Democratic Party. Now, there was a lot of hyperventilating over that, and Geraldine was made to pay for it, but it was obviously true. You look at his credentials. Look at who he is. Look at what he'd done. Look at what he hadn't done and how little we knew about him. We had reporters sitting around after the election was over, kind of looking stunned and saying to themselves, we don't really know this guy. We know so little about him. Do you really believe that he would have been nominated if he'd been white? Less than a full term in the Senate? Less than 2 years, wasn't it, in the Senate? He just hardly any time in the world of politics at all. He was inexperienced. Well, the country will survive for now because of our Constitution, which balances the power of the president over against the power of Congress. But I think we're in for some rough seas, made all the worse because we can't be sure at any time we are being told the truth. This is really distressing when you think about it. Even the news telling us how people's opinions are skewed may itself be influenced by skewed opinions. Oddly, what we're talking about here is a kind of idolatry. What's your defense against all of this? Well, the simplest defense is a love of the truth, a love for the Bible, and a distrust of your own opinions. That last is crucial. Because in Proverbs 14, verse 12, there is this simple statement. There is a way that seems right to a man, but in the end it leads to death. Trust in God with all your heart, and don't lean on your own opinion.
The Born to Win radio program with Ronald L. Dart is sponsored by Christian Educational Ministries and made possible by donations from listeners like you. If you can help, please send your donation to Born to Win, Post Office Box 560, White House, Texas 75791. You may call us at 1-888-BIBLE-44 and visit us online at borntowin.net.